pairs. Let's push the sister page 484. Parshas Kisisa is an interesting parsha. Firstly, just having a look at the structure of Parshas Kisisa. We know that every parsha is divided into seven parts, right? Because we have seven aliyahs on Shabbos. We call seven people up to the Torah. And normally they fairly evenly sort of divided in, not always, but more or less, they sort of have a Parashat Kisisa have an interesting structure that the Rishon and Sheni, the first two call-ups, you'll notice are very, very long. Just if you have a look, you'll see the first one goes all the way to 492. And then the second one goes all the way to 504, right? And then they're very short. All of them are very short. So it's completely uneven. It's a long parsha, but the length of the parsha is in the first two call-ups. That's where it is. I mentioned that only because there's actually a reason for it. There's a reason given why it's structured that way. And that is that we know this parsha contains the famous story of the golden calf, the Egel Hazav. The Jews sinned in the Egel Hazav. Now there's a halacha in the laws of the reading of the Torah on Shabbos. That you're supposed to avoid at least calling up someone to the Torah that has transgressed an avera which is written in that particular call up because it's embarrassing, right? So, like, you don't call up someone who stole in a parasha that says you shouldn't steal, right? That kind of thing. It's an, it could be
the
criminally convicted. Huh? No, no. If it's a well-known thing, we're talking about if it's known, right? No, not quite. So they say like this: that when the Egel Hazav was finished. When the golden calf was finished, we know that everyone essentially was guilty. Although there were only 3,000 people that actually served the golden calf. But nevertheless, everyone was sort of supportive of it, with the exception of one tribe, and that was the tribe of Levi. Right? So therefore, since everyone is guilty with the Egel Hazav, we need to get the golden calf story, at least in the second aliyah, at least. Because that's the aliyah we call it a Levi, right? Either Kohen or Levi, they both come from the tribe of Levi. And that's why we structure the parasha in such a way where we go long and long so that we get the Egel Hazav into the second aliyah, what we call the Levi. And then the rest of the parasha becomes fairly short. So that's one of the themes, one of the reasons why we do that.
But why were the women punished as well, basically? Because they weren't involved in the
Egel Hazav. No, but they don't get an aliyah.
I'm just speaking.
Oh, generally. No, they weren't punished. I mean, even the tribe of Levi was also punished. I mean, there was a sort of a national effect of the Egel Hazav. It says like this: it says that when Adam Arishon sinned with the first fruit, right, the Eitz Hadas, the original sin, so that brought impurity into the world, and that continued to get worse until the Mabul, etc. Then there were seven tzaddikim. It says that brought the Shechina, brought the divine presence, back to the world. Culminating in Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu brought the sort of the divine presence back to the world, and that was Matan Torah. So at Matan Torah, when the Torah was given, the world was sort of restored to a state of purity. Yeah? But then when the Jews sinned with the Egel Hazav, with the golden calf, they introduced a spiritual filth into the world once again, and we're still suffering from that until Mashiach comes. So it's not a matter of being punished, it's a matter of being affected, that's all. And that's an interesting thing,
because
no, the women didn't give jewelry. The women didn't give. That was all idea. The women didn't give the jewelry. That's why it says if you look, only the men gave the jewelry. At that time, the men also wore jewelry, and the men gave the jewelry. The women actually stayed out of it. That was the whole. That was one of the things. The women never seemed to get in trouble with these things. The Egel Hazav, the spies, they always managed to stay focused. It's always the men that messed up. You see, that's what happens. That's right. All right. So therefore, the way. So that's.
Sorry, just
It's okay. It's a few days after Purim. We're still in the Purim spirit. That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, so anyway, that's just a bit of an introduction in terms of how the parasha is structured. So what happens in the parasha is that the first aliyah, till Sheni, has a bunch of different themes. Then in Sheni, it gets into this whole story of the golden calf, and then continues on this couple of other topics that follow on, the whole idea of the second luchais, and the tshuva that followed is in the rest of the parasha. So first I wanted to do is just have a look at, just briefly, some of the things that are in the first aliyah, some of the themes. So the first thing is the mitzvah of machtzis ha-shekel. We've dealt with that a little bit before, so we'll just very quickly look at it. The beginning of the parasha, page 484. So it says, "Vaydaber Hashem u'Moshe Leimer." Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, "Kisisos reish b'nei Yisrael lifkodeim." When you count, when you take a census of the b'nei Yisrael, right, for the numbers, "V'nosnu ish koyf nafsha." Each person should give an atonement of their soul, la Hashem to God bifkoyd oisam. When you count them, lo yiyeh v'hem negef bifkoyd oisam. There will not be a plague when you count them. So essentially, what Torah is saying is that whenever there's a census taken for the Jewish people, you're not permitted to count the Jewish people. You have to actually only count the coins. And that's why the Jewish people were commanded to give a half a shekel, and each half a shekel was used then to count to see how many people there were. And that's the way it was done in the time of the Midrash. That actually is an ongoing mitzvah. That's a mitzvah that exists still today, and that's why there's a prohibition against counting people. One of the reasons in the time of David HaMelech, there was a story where he did count the Jewish people because he thought the mitzvah didn't apply anymore, and a plague broke out, and there was a problem, an epidemic, because he made them vulnerable to the evil eye, to the eye in horror, because he counted them, right? So therefore there's a prohibition against counting people, and then it's included, as I said, it's included nowadays. That's why in shul, for example, or if you want to know if you're counting people for a minyan or whatever the case is, you're actually not permitted to count people even today. That's saying 1, 2, 3, 4. You have to count them in an obscure way. Either there's a pasuk people say, Hashir Asamecha Avorachas Nachalasecha, right? You heard that? There's a pasuk that's got 10 words. Hashir Asamecha Avorachas Nachalasecha Urein Venasim Ad Ha'olam. That's how you count for a minion, you count them. Or there's an old tradition of saying not one. You know, you say not one, not two, not three. Right? Sorry? Yeah, Nishtayin, Nishtayin, that's right. Yeah. So that's the idea, because you're actually not allowed to count people. There's even a whole interesting shaila. I mean, there's different ways of getting around it, and there's different loopholes in heterium that are given to this concept. But there's even a shaila whether in Israel, where the majority of the population is Jewish, where actually it's permitted to conduct a census, and if you're actually allowed to even participate in the census. That's a shaila that's discussed in the poskim based on this mitzvah. Bottom line is there are various ways around it, and there's really reasons why you can. But it's just interesting that the shaila is brought down, and it's all a continuation, extension of this particular mitzvah, and therefore there's that mitzvah of giving the shekel. Mitzvah giving half a shekel then continued on in the time of the Beis HaMikdash on a different level, where there was a mitzvah to give a half a shekel every single year. And that was the mitzvah to donate towards the fund that bought animals for the sacrifices, the korbanos. And that's why every month of Adar, actually, this time of the year, people would donate half a shekel, and with that money they would buy the new animals for the new year, starting on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And that would be the cycle of the year, where they would bring new sacrifices for that year. All right. Have a look on the next page. We'll just skim over different concepts here. We know that these parshas, Truma, Tetzaveh, we had last 2 weeks, and then this week, and the next few weeks, have a lot to do with the building of the Mishkan. So we had the building of the Mishkan in the portion of Truma, which included, as I said in the Shiurim then, both the structure of the Mishkan and the Kalim, the vessels of the Mishkan. One vessel that wasn't talked about that seems to be left for this parsha, which is kept separate, is the Kiyar, the sink, just the basin. Just have a look at it briefly. So we learn in the Psukim, Vayadaber Hashem Moshe Leimer, and Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, Ve'asisa Kiyar Nechoshes, you shall make a basin out of copper, V'chanoi Nechoshes, and the base should also be made out of copper, the rochzon will be used for washing, and you should place the basin between the sanctuary, between the actual structure and the mizbeach, and you should place water there. And Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands, they should wash every day their hands and their feet. Right? Bevoyam el oil moir, when they come to the sanctuary, yurcha tzumayim v'lo yimus, they should wash their hands and they won't die. Oy begishtam al hamizbeach, or every time they go close to the mizbeach, l'shores to serve, l'haktir isha l'Hashem, to bring a offering to Hashem. V'rochatsu yideim v'ragleim, they should wash their hands and their feet. Lo yomusu, they won't die. V'hoysa lehem l'chok oylam, this will be an everlasting statute. Loy ulazari l'doreisam, for him and his children. Essentially what that meant was, that every day the Kohanim, when they would come to the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan, and they would begin their service, the avoda, the serving in the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, they would have the command that they have to always wash their hands and their feet before they begin the day. Just I wanted to just learn this inside, because also just to mention an interesting thing, that in Shulchan Aruch we know we have the halacha that every day we are also supposed to be obligated to wash our hands in the morning 6 times, right? Negavasa we call it. And in Shulchan Aruch there's various reasons given for that practice, for that halacha. One of the reasons that is given, there's 3 reasons given in Shulchan Aruch. One of the reasons that's given is that every Jew is considered a kohen, right? We have our own sort of mini Beis HaMikdash, we have our own sort of sanctuary, we have our own private Beis HaMikdash, we are the kohanim in our own Beis HaMikdash, and we do the avoda, we serve Hashem in our own Beis HaMikdash. And that's why when we get up every day in the morning, we compare to a kohen going into the Mishkan to do the avoda, and that's why we have to wash our hands. That's the practice of washing Negavas every morning, to remind ourselves that we are just like the kohanim who would wash their hands when they would begin the service in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, then in the next part of the parasha we have the making of the incense and how the ketores, the spices, had to be prepared every day to bring on the Mizbeach. And then, if you just look towards the end of this aliyah, we have the mitzvah of Shabbos. Right? Shabbos comes up a number of times in the Chumash, and this is one of the times. And let's have a look at it. It's on page 490, Pasuk Yud Beis, Pasuk 12. Verse 12, yeah. And the Chumash says the following, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe lemar. And Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, Ve'ata, and you, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Bnei Yisrael lemar. He's speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu, he's asking him to communicate to the Bnei Yisrael. Ve'ata, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Bnei Yisrael lemar saying, Ach es shapsoisai tishmoyer. Ach means but, like be careful, sort of but. You should make sure to guard my Shabbos. Ki ois hi beini uveinechem. Shabbos is a sign between me and you. The doyre sechem for all your generations. The das to remember ki ani Hashem mekadishchem, that I am God who makes you holy. Right? And then he goes on to warn the whole of the halachos of Shabbos. And ends off, if you just have a look at the page 492, he ends off with the psukim that we say every Shabbos, right? Pasuk Tes Zayin 16, Shomru b'nei Yisrael es haShabbos, the Jewish people shall observe the Shabbos. La'asor es haShabbos, to make the Shabbos l'doreisam, for all generations, bris olam, an everlasting covenant. Beini uvein b'nei Yisrael, between me and the Jewish people. Oisi la'olam, it's an eternal sign. Shabbos is one of the signs that connect us with Hashem. Kisheshes yamim osa Hashem es haShemayim es haOretz, because 6 days Hashem made the heaven and the earth. Vayom haShvi'i Shavas vayinafash, and on the 7th day he rested. Yeah, and was refreshed, so to speak. And that's why we keep the Shabbos. So the question is, why do we have this expression? Right, this paragraph starts off in an interesting way. It says, "Ach," Hashem says, "but." Be careful, you must keep the Shabbos. What's the ach? We have a tradition in the Gemara, in the Talmud, that every time it says the word ach, it's coming to exclude something. It's coming to warn us about something. Right? The term ach. Ach et shav, shall I say, but. Like, what's the but on here, right? So Rashi brings that it's coming to teach us this halacha, that although we've been learning up to now about the construction of the Mishkan, and how great the mitzvah was to construct the Mishkan, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu warns the Bnei Yisrael that notwithstanding the importance of building the Mishkan, and that was the instruction till now, both parshas Truma, Tetzaveh, and now building the sink, etc., etc., says the Torah, Ach, but, Eshapsoisai Tishmur, you have to keep the Shabbos. In other words, you may not build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Right? That's the That's the ach. So the Mefarshim asked the question, the commentaries asked the question like this. Why is it so necessary for the Torah to warn us not to build the Mishkan and Shavuos? Not to burn fire, not to build, not to construct the Mishkan and Shavuos. Why would we think you can build a Mishkan and Shavuos? Right? Why should we think that building a Mishkan should override the mitzvah of Shabbos? We already learned in the Ten Commandments in Parashat Yisro we should keep Shabbos. The mitzvah of Shabbos has already been given. In fact, according to some commentaries, the mitzvah of Shabbos was even given before Matan Torah. It was given when they came through a little town called Mora, where certain mitzvahs were given as a preview before Matan Torah. And therefore, why would we think that you can build a Mishkan on Shabbos? And just to explain the question a bit, on a halachic level, we know that there's sometimes that mitzvahs conflict with each other, right? And we have a principle, what do we do when mitzvahs sort of conflict with each other, when mitzvahs clash? So there are various halachic guidelines. For example, we have a principle sometimes that mitzvahs asay doiche lois asay, which means a positive commandment can override a negative commandment, right? I'll give you an example, the only one that comes to mind that the Gemara talks about. The Gemara talks about an example that there's a mitzvah in the Torah that if someone develops tzaras, if someone develops leprosy, right, which is spoken about later on in the Chumash, which is not really leprosy, it's a spiritual disease more that we don't have today, but it's a skin condition at the end of the day, right, which has certain criteria, and it's called tzaras. If someone develops tzaras, there's a negative commandment in the Torah that you're not permitted to cut that tzaras out of your skin. Right? You have to leave it there. You have to take it to the Kohen. The Kohen has to decide whether it's pure or impure. And then, whatever the process is, you have to let it heal on its own. And when it heals, then the person can go through a purification process. But to actually physically remove it from the body, that's actually an isra, it's a prohibition, it's one of the negative commandments. Right? So the Gemara poses the question, what happens if a baby is born, a boy, and there's a problem because when you need to circumcise the baby, there's tzaras. So you have two mitzvahs that clash. On one hand, there's a mitzvah to circumcise the child. On the other hand, there's a prohibition to remove tzaras from the body. Right? So that's one of the instances where the Gemara brings an example that mitzvahs asay doiche lois asay. That the mitzvah saseh, a positive commandment, overrides a negative commandment. So there's a positive commandment to circumcise a child. It's a negative commandment not to remove the tzaras. The positive commandment then overrides a negative commandment, and you go ahead and you circumcise the child. Okay? But that has limitations, that concept. Why? That's when you have a mitzvah that's a positive commandment, clashing with a mitzvah that's only a negative commandment. But when you have something clashing with Shabbos, for example, you wouldn't say that, because Shabbos itself is both a negative commandment and a positive commandment. Right? There's a commandment on Shabbos, lo sasa melacha, you shall not do work. There's a positive commandment, you shall keep the Shabbos. So therefore, if another positive commandment clashes with Shabbos, so you can't say that the positive commandment overrides a negative commandment, because a positive commandment only overrides a negative commandment if it's only a negative commandment. But if it's a positive and a negative, it doesn't override. Right? Which, by the way, just out of interest, just to digress a moment, that's why we know that, for example, let's take Bris Milah as an example again, circumcision does override Shabbos, but for a different reason. It overrides Shabbos because there's a special pasuk in the Torah, an extra pasuk that says you should circumcise a child even on Shabbos. Right? And the Gemara asks that question, why do we need a special pasuk? Why can't we just derive it from the general halachic principle that a positive commandment overrides a negative commandment? And the answer is you cannot use that principle, because Shabbos is a negative commandment and a positive commandment. And therefore, just on that principle alone, Bris Milah circumcision would not override Shabbos. The only reason that it does is because we have a special pasuk to teach you that it should. Okay? Why am I bringing this in? Because this reinforces that question. Why would the Jewish people think that the mitzvah to build a Mishkan should override Shabbos? The mitzvah to build a Mishkan is a positive commandment. True. The mitzvah to keep Shabbos, however, is a positive and a negative commandment. So why should the Mishkan override Shabbos? Why would they have to think that? Why do we need the Torah to come and specially warn us that the Mishkan shouldn't override Shabbos? Okay. So we have various commentaries that deal with this question. So the one of the commentaries is a commentary on the Mishnah. The Bar Tanura, and he says that no, the Jews wouldn't have thought that the construction of the Mishkan would override Shabbos. They'd have just maybe taken a few halachas of the Mishkan, the ones that are maybe less severe. There are certain activities in the Mishkan that are not so severe, and they thought maybe those can be overridden on Shabbos. So the Torah says, no, you have to completely cease all working. The Mizrahi is a commentary on Rashi. And he suggests an interesting answer, why we need the Torah to specially command us that we shouldn't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. And he says like this, he says, because the Mishkan was a confusing thing for the Jewish people. Because building the Mishkan involves certain activities that prohibit on Shabbos, right? Constructing, burning fires, whatever the case is. Yet, the Jewish people knew that when the Mishkan would be set up, there would be activities that would override Shabbos. For example, we know that in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, on Shabbos, they brought sacrifices. They brought korbanos. There was a daily korban that needed to be brought every single day in the Beis HaMikdash and in the Mishkan, called the korban tomid, that was brought on Shabbos as well. Right? Now, that particular, and also on Shabbos, there were extra korbanos. The Musaf korbanos. Every korban that was brought involved many prohibited activities of Shabbos. Shechting the animal, for one. Creating a fire on the Mizbeach. Skinning the animal. Right? So many, and more. I mean, there were so many activities that was involved in bringing in bringing a korban that involved transgressing Shabbos. So the Mizrahi says that the Jews could have very easily made the following conclusion. They could have looked at the whole Mishkan and said, listen, it seems to be obvious that the process of the Mishkan, right, the process of the Mishkan overrides Shabbos. What's the best proof? The best proof is that when the Mishkan will be up, we are given a specific command that the korbanos need to continue on Shabbos. So if the korbanos need to continue on Shabbos, why shouldn't the construction continue on Shabbos? Right, that would have been their thought process. Comes along the Torah and says, no. Acher Shabbos Tishmor. It might be that when the Mishkan is up, you still need to bring korbanos on Shabbos. But the building of the Mishkan cannot take place on Shabbos. The building of the Mishkan has to cease on Shabbos. That's the mon. The mon that would fall from heaven.
No. In Beit HaMikdash, they put also on Shabbat, on the table, on the Shulchan, also on Shabbat the bread, or they used...
The bread that was put on the table, that was only put on Shabbos. It was put every Shabbos.
It was put on Shabbos.
Yeah. It was put on Shabbos, it was taken away the next Shabbos, replaced by new ones. On Shabbos. Yeah, that was one of the things that would take place on Shabbos. But that wasn't such a problem. That didn't involve any work on Shabbos. That was just putting bread there. But the... although maybe it was baked on Shabbos, actually.
Then they got the mon double on Friday.
No, that was the mon. The mon, the manna that fell from heaven. Yeah, that wasn't collected on Shabbos, and that was put... That fell double on Shabbos, right? That fell double on Friday.
On Friday.
Yeah, correct.
Could they take that mon and put it in the...
No, it was two different things. Two separate issues. The mon was the mon, and this was bread that was actually placed on a table on Shabbos. Yeah. But maybe it was baked on Shabbos, I'm not sure, I don't remember. Okay. So he says that's why we need the special mitzvah to warn the Jewish people not to make a Mishkan on Shabbos. Because they knew that the Mishkan would involve Chilul Shabbos when they do the Korbanos. And therefore they were told that the building. Okay, that's what he says. But the truth is we need to understand this. Because if that's the case, why is it that the Mishkan has to stop on Shabbos? Why the building of the Mishkan cannot take place on Shabbos, but the sacrifices could? Right? Why is it like that? I mean, why is that distinction? And it's a strange thing. Why is there that if Shabbos is so important, how come so many activities of Shabbos, prohibited activities, were carried out on the Mishkan on Shabbos in the Beis HaMikdash? How come that Hashem said you can't make a fire on Shabbos, but you can make one in the Beis HaMikdash? You can't shecht an animal, but you can shecht in the Beis HaMikdash. Why is it actually? Right? And if it is important to do the Beis HaMikdash, why couldn't the building take place on Shabbos? Right? We need to understand that distinction. So just to explain this a little bit, to share something with you that I think we might have done a long time ago, but it would explain this idea as well. And that is that we find in the Torah an interesting thing. We find, generally, there's a Gemara that says that very often we find that whatever Hashem prohibited in the Torah, there are permissible forms of the same thing. Right? For example, it says that you're not allowed to make a fire. The Beis HaMikdash was a fire on Shabbos. It says that a person may not marry his brother's wife, yet in certain circumstances it becomes a mitzvah to marry your brother's wife. In the case of Yibum, right? In the Torah, we don't do it today, but there's a concept in the Torah called Yibum. If a person's brother passes away without any children, his wife becomes, it's a mitzvah to marry her. If not, there's chalitza, which we do today. But, right? Normally that relationship would be a forbidden relationship, almost an adulterous relationship. And yet, this is considered a mitzvah, right? So the same relationship that the Torah prohibits, in circumstances becomes not only permitted, but even a mitzvah. The Torah says you cannot wear shatnez, you cannot wear woolen linen, yet the Kohen Gadol wore woolen linen. So it becomes a mitzvah, right? So a strange thing, is something intrinsically bad or it's not intrinsically bad? What's the definition of something that's evil? If it's bad, it's bad. If it's good, it's good. How come sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good? What does it mean? How does it work, right? So the short answer is, and we'll develop this with regard to Shabbos, that there are many, many things that are not intrinsically bad. We've spoken about this many times. There are certain things, there are certain powers that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created in the world, certain emotions, certain activities, certain experiences, that are not intrinsically bad. In fact, nothing's intrinsically bad. Hashem created everything. We know that that's part of the fundamental of our belief, that everything that is created by HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a purpose. Like it says in Pirkei Avos, that kol ma shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever Hashem created, lebara lechvod, He created for His glory, everything ultimately must be able to serve a purpose. Right? However, many, many things, it depends in what context. Certain things, when it's experienced in a particular way, it's evil, because it goes against the connection to Hashem. Whereas if you take the same thing and you experience it in a particular environment, in a particular context, it becomes holy, because it's done in the right way. So, obviously that needs to be understood in every situation differently, but let's understand with regard to Shabbos. So with regard to Shabbos, there's an interesting Gemara. That the Gemara says, I've forgotten who it was, but there was a certain heretic who came and asked one of the sages of the Gemara a particular question. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's a principle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps all of his mitzvahs, his own mitzvahs, right? We know that because it says, we say in davening, in Tehillim, there's a pasuk that says, Magid Dvarov LeYaakov, Hashem tells His words to Yaakov, Chukav U'Mishpatav LeYisrael, His own mitzvahs He gives to the Jewish people. Like the Medrash says, sometimes you have a ruler that commands his subjects to do certain things, but he doesn't follow the same commands. When it comes to Hashem, he does. And we find many examples of this in the Gemara. For example, there's a Gemara in Brachas that says, what is written in Hashem's tefillin? Hashem tells us to wear tefillin. What is written in His tefillin? Right? Obviously, it means on a spiritual level, it doesn't mean a physical tefillin, but it's the same. Right? We find a case in the Gemara where one of the great sages of the Gemara was asked a question by a non-Jew. He said, you know, he quoted a pasuk that Elokeichem Kohen Hu, your God is a Kohen. Hashem is described somewhere as a Kohen. So he said, if a God is a Kohen, how could He bury Moshe Rabbeinu? It says in the end of the Chumash that Hashem Himself buried Moshe Rabbeinu. How can a Kohen do that? Etc. All these different questions, all centered around the same theme, that Hashem keeps His own mitzvah, so to speak. Right? So this particular sage was asked a question. He said, if Hashem keeps His own mitzvah, so presumably Hashem keeps Shabbos. Right? Hashem keeps Shabbos, how could He make it rain on Shabbos?
Automatic pilot.
Sorry?
Automatic pilot.
Time switch, huh?
Time clock.
He makes a time clock. Okay. How could He make it rain on Shabbos? Can He make it rain? You're watering the plants? Okay. So that's always the question. But the answer is even stranger. So he answered him like this. He said, because for Hashem, the entire world is a Roshus HaYachad, it's a private domain. You know, for us, there's private domains and there's public domains. We call in Shabbos Roshus HaYachad and Roshus HaRabin. Private domain, public domain, right? But because Hashem is the owner of the entire universe, He's called Yechidoy Shel Olam, He's the one reality that really exists in this world. So therefore for Him, there's like a one big massive global Eruv, right? Everything, Hashem is, it's all private domain. And therefore it's not a problem. But if you think about it, what kind of answer is that? Correct, correct, exactly.
Because right. Hashem is actually creating.
Eruv, once I was at Eruv, Eruv allows us to carry, that's all. Mm-hmm. Carrying is only one of the 39 melachas.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you can't water your grass in an Eruv. Mm-hmm. Right? You can't cook in an Eruv, right? So why does it help us? Why does it help us to actually understand why Hashem can make the water grow? I mean the grass grow on Shabbos. But actually, in the answer that he gave lies a very, very deep understanding of what Shabbos is all about and why we keep Shabbos. And that'll help us understand why Hashem could water the grass and why in the Beis HaMikdash they could do certain prohibited activities. So to understand it, we have to understand it like this. It says in Kabbalah that on Shabbos, Hashem elevates the world from the level of speech to the level of thought. When Hashem created the world, we know that the world was created with speech, right? We say, Ba'asara ma'amorais nivra ha'olam. Hashem created the world with 10 utterances. Right? There's a concept of dibur, the concept of speech, that Hashem created the world. Which we need to also understand what that means. Why would he use the term speech to describe Hashem's creation? Hashem, we know that it has no physical form, and yet we talk about speech. What does that mean? And also, what does it mean that Hashem stops creating on Shabbos? Hashem didn't create on Shabbos. We know that Hashem creates the world constantly. So what does it mean? He rested on Shabbos, He didn't create the world. So it says that on Shabbos, Hashem elevates the world. The world is elevated from a level of speech to a level of thought. From Dibur to Machshava. That's why there's a very interesting Gemara Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says that it was with great difficulty that the rabbis permitted us to talk on Shabbos, even words of Torah. In other words, in theory, Shabbos should be a day of silence. That's what they said, right? But of course, that's too difficult for human beings. So they permitted us to speak, but they limited the speech. That's why on Shabbos we're not supposed to speak things that are mundane. We're supposed to be involved in things which are more holy, right? But why would they say a thing like that? Because the same idea. On Shabbos, the world is elevated. Shabbos is not to do with speech. Shabbos is to do with the world of Machshava. What does that mean? When Hashem created the world, He used speech. What's the difference between speech and thought? Right. So we know from ourselves that sometimes you can say something in many words, that a long speech, a long thesis was born out of one single thought. Right. Sometimes you have a flashing thought about something, and then when it comes to communicate it, but you can't communicate that one thought to everyone else. In order to communicate it, you need to break it down. You need to break it down into sentences, into words. Yeah, every word is different from the next word, every sentence is different from the next sentence, every paragraph is different, until you have an entire essay. So when I communicate to you something, I say many, many different words, each word is different, each sentence is different, each paragraph is different. But the hope is that at the end of the entire thing, you somehow get the one uniting thought that governs the whole essay, right? So the difference between speech and thought is this. Thought is a united power. It's a unified power. In other words, thought is what binds everything together. Speech, by definition, is breaking something up into different words and different sentences. That's the difference between speech and thought. When Hashem created the world by design, He obviously wanted us to come to terms and to acknowledge that He is the governing force behind every single part of creation. Right? But Hashem did not want to make that obvious. He wanted that not to be obvious. He wanted us to struggle to discover it. So what did He do? He created a world of dibur, created a world of speech. In other words, He created a world of multiplicity, He created a world where there's thousands and millions of different creations, where each blade of grass is different from the other, each tree is different, each person is different, each person thinks differently, each person does things differently, right? Each person's profession is different, each person's work is different, each person's ideas are different.
Fingerprints
are different, exactly, right? So that it should look like a world of total multiplicity, it should look like a world of total division. And that's the dibur, that's the speech. So during the week, what's the most emphasized what's the most obvious in the entire creation is the speech. Everything's different. It is difficult during the week to remember and to acknowledge and to recognize the one governing force which is behind everything, which is the Koyach Hashem, the power of Hashem. The purpose, of course, being is that we shouldn't remain by that level of speech. The purpose being that we should discover that although everything appears to be different, but in fact everything is united. Everything is really governed by one thought, and that's the power of Hashem. That we should understand that although I do one thing and you do something else, although one person's a lawyer, one person's a doctor, one person does this work and that person does this activity, one person's experience is different from another person's experience, really they're all the same, really they're all focused on the one thing, connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They might do it differently, this one might do it as a tree, this one might do it as an animal, but it's all one thing really. In order to make it easy for us, because at the end of the day we live in a world of multiplicity, we live in a world where it's not obvious, where what's more obvious is the dibur, is the speech, not the machshav, not the thought. So he gave us a Shabbos. Right? What does the word Shabbos actually mean? The word Shabbos means to stop, to cease, to withdraw. Right? It means rest also, but actually much more than rest. You know, the term Shabbos is also used when it comes to Pesach, for example. We have to get rid of the chametz, that uses the same word, tashbisu. Same word, right? Because Shabbos means like a complete stop, a complete break. Shabbos, what happens is, the world is elevated to a power of thought, which means that Shabbos, if we tune into the spirit of Shabbos, on Shabbos the thought becomes more obvious. The governing force of the whole creation being the power of Hashem becomes more obvious. If we tune into it, if we're able to connect to it. How do we connect to it? We connect to it on Shabbos by withdrawing from the world of speech. On Shabbos we stop doing work. We move away from our differences. On Shabbos we stop doing the different things that we each do. We stop creating, we stop doing. And we all do the one thing. We all focus on a more spiritual level, on davening and learning and kriyas haTorah and celebrating Shabbos, etc. In other words, we withdraw from the world of multiplicity as much as we possibly can, and we connect to the machshav. The purpose, of course, being not to remain with Shabbos. The purpose, of course, being that when we leave Shabbos, we should take that recognition with us. And that when we once again descend into the world of multiplicity, we should remember and we should be able to be conscious of that even in the world of multiplicity, it's really all one thing. We should be able to recognize the oneness of Hashem in the multitude of different things that we experience during the week. But sometimes it gets hard and we get caught up in the multiplicity. So therefore, every Shabbos we can again withdraw into the world of thought, and therefore we can have that power again and the recognition again in order to take it with us, that inspiration with us in the next week. Right? Incidentally, a fascinating thing, that's why one of the 39 activities of Shabbos is not to carry. Why is that? Why do I say that? Because there's actually a very huge question about the melacha. There are 39 prohibited activities of Shabbos, right? Which we call the 39 melachas. One of them happens to be carrying. The problem is that the carrying actually doesn't fit into the other 39 by definition. Because if you know the definition of work on Shabbos, it doesn't mean physical work. The definition of work on Shabbos we know means not to create, not to change the form of something. Right? You can't light a flame, but you could schlep a bookshelf. Why? Because you light a flame, you're creating something new. When you cook, you're changing the form of something. When you sew something, you're taking two separate pieces of garment and you make a new entity, right, etc. So all the 39 melachas are all about changing the form of something. With the exception of carrying. Carrying is the one malacha we don't change the form of anything. The same object you carry remains exactly the same object, doesn't it? It's no difference. There's always a question, what has carrying got to do with Shabbos? And the answer that's given is that carrying has nothing to do with the rest of the malachas, but carrying in a sense actually epitomizes what Shabbos is all about. Because the whole theme behind the malacha of carrying is this whole distinction between multiplicity and oneness. It's about not carrying in a street, but you're allowed to carry in a private domain. Private domain means there's a wall around it. A private domain has a uniting force to it. Everything is one. So on Shabbos, we restrict it in a public domain because on Shabbos, the whole idea is to withdraw from multiplicity, to withdraw from the public domain, and to only operate more in a private domain where the oneness of Hashem is more emphasized. That whole concept of going away from the world of Dibur and going into the world of Machshava, the world of multiplicity, into the world of oneness. Right? understanding that, we can now understand the whole discussion in the Gemara. So he asks him, how can Hashem make the water grow, make the grass grow? So he answers, because for Hashem, the whole world is a private domain. What does that mean? What it means is that the whole purpose of withdrawing from work on Shabbos is because when we remain in the world of work, we are remaining in the world of Dibur. We're remaining in the world of multiplicity, and therefore we need to get out of that world, so we should appreciate the oneness, right? But he answered them that Hashem is always in the world of oneness. That multiplicity, that dibur, that multitude of creations that to us seems to hide and conceal the oneness of Hashem is only from our perception. When Hashem created the world, He never departed from the world of oneness. To Him it was always obvious that the multiplicity in the world is all an extension of Him. He never left the world of oneness to go into the world of multiplicity. It's only from our perspective. And therefore he said that when you live in the world of oneness, work isn't a problem. When you live in the world of oneness like Hashem does, when you live in the world of Yechidoi Shel Olam, where the whole world is one, then different activities don't conceal Hashem's oneness. And making the grass grow and working and plowing or doing anything you do doesn't conceal Hashem's oneness. It's all in that world, it's automatically obvious that it's the hand of Hashem. It's in our world that it's not. It's in our world and the world of Dibur, where remaining in the world of work camouflages Hashem's presence, and therefore to tap into the oneness that prevails on Shabbos, we need to get out of that world and go into the world of oneness. But for Hashem, He doesn't need to do that, because He is, that's what He meant to say. It's not an Eruv story. He meant to say that He remains in the world of oneness. He is in Rishus HaYachid. It's all Yechidoi Shel Olam. It's a world of oneness to begin with, and therefore making the grass grow for Him is not our issue. The Shabbos recognition, the Shabbos experience, doesn't need the withdrawal from that world. Only for us it needs it. For us we need to withdraw from that world. Hashem, He doesn't. Why did I share this all with you? Because that now explains the whole concept of why making a fire is forbidden, but it's not forbidden in the Beis HaMikdash. Because in the Beis HaMikdash, it's the same idea. Work, in other words, the world of Dibur, the activities that come with the world of Dibur are not intrinsically bad. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with cooking or making a fire or doing any of the other things that are prohibited on Shabbos. They're only bad, they're only evil when they camouflage, when they conceal the oneness of Hashem. We on Shabbos need to move away from it because in our reality, we'll never access Hashem's oneness unless we withdraw from that world. But ultimately, there's nothing that contradicts Hashem's oneness. Ultimately, the world of Dibur is not a contradiction to Hashem's oneness. Ultimately, the world that Hashem created, if you look in the essay, you'll see the governing thought. Hashem's oneness should be obvious in every reality, even the world of multiplicity. And that's why when you go into the Beis HaMikdash, in the Beis HaMikdash itself, the Beis HaMikdash was an environment where Hashem's oneness was obvious on all levels. And therefore, in the world of the Beis HaMikdash, when you came into that world, shechting an animal and lighting a fire did not contradict Hashem's oneness. And then from the Beis HaMikdash, it was okay. It's outside of the Beis HaMikdash that's a problem. Outside of the Beis HaMikdash, it becomes contradictory, and therefore you have to withdraw from that world. But inside the Beis HaMikdash, it wasn't a problem. Right? So now we can understand why building the Mishkan is a problem on Shabbos, but being in the Mishkan, you can still do some of these activities. Because building the Mishkan means you haven't yet reached the level of the Mishkan. You're still in the world outside of the Mishkan. In that world, you have to stop on Shabbos. And that's what the Torah says, Achre Shabsoi Sai Tishmoiru, you have to stop, and you cannot build the Mishkan on Shabbos. But once the Mishkan is there, and the Shekhinah came down into the Mishkan, and the Hashem's presence was felt in the Mishkan, and therefore when you walked into the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, the oneness of Hashem was so obvious, you can bring karbonis, you can light fires, you can shecht animals, and it's not a problem. On the contrary, it becomes something that's all part of the spiritual experience. It's not a problem. It's not a contradiction. And therefore, there's that distinction. But for fear that the Yidden would confuse that and not understand the difference between building the Mishkan and being in the Mishkan, Hashem had to specially caution the Jewish people not to build the Mishkan on Shabbos. So that just explains that idea. Okay. What's that? Alright, let's just a little bit have a look at the next part of the parasha. So I just want to mention, I mean, we've done a lot of stuff on the golden calf before, but I want to just quickly touch on something. So we know that later on we have a big problem with the Egel Azor. The problem is, we know that, well, let's look at a few psukim inside a little bit. Pasuk Yitches, that's page 492. Vayitein el Moshe, and Hashem gave to Moshe Rabbeinu kechalois el adaber itoi, when he finished speaking to him, b'hasinai and hasinai, shnei luchai sa'edus, he gave him the two tablets. Now on page 492. Luchai sa'edus, they were tablets of stone. Ksuvim be'etz palakim, they were written and inscribed with the finger of God. In other words, they were divinely inscribed. So that's the end of the first 40 days. We're talking about the 16th, 17th of Tammuz. Moshe Rabbeinu was given the tablets and he was told to bring the Ten Commandments down to the Jewish people. And that was the Luchis. Then, of course, we have the famous problem, Ayarhom, Kiboshesh Moshe. And the nation saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was delayed. Aredes min Nahar to come down from the mountain. Vaykoil ha'om al Aron. So they gathered around Aron, Vayom Re'elim, and they sent to him, Kum ha'selonu elakim, make for us a God. Asher yelchul lefoneinu, that should go before us. Kizeh Moshe ish, this Moshe, this man, Asher he'elonu, took us out of Egypt. We don't know what happened to him. And from that started the whole story. And the result was a golden calf. Of course, a very, very problematic story. No one really understands what it means. We've gone through various explanations in the past of what actually happened there. How could the Jews do this? How could they fail? What they actually wanted to do? What was their purpose? But at the end, it was a bad ending. They ended up serving Avodah Zarah. Many of them were punished, and we're still suffering this Egel Azor today. One of the concepts of Egel Azor, of course, is, we've talked about this in the past, is the whole idea of tshuva. But the Gemara says that that Hashem set the Jewish people up to serve the golden calf in order to introduce into the world the concept of tshuva. Right? That they should struggle through the challenge and they should reconnect to Hashem even in a stronger way. So, just to bring this out in one interesting way is this. We know that there's a tremendous machlokes about how the order of these parshiyos work, right? So let's just give a bit of an overview. Last 2 weeks we read Truma and Tetzaveh. Truma and Tetzaveh is Hashem's command to the Jewish people to build a Mishkan. Right? Then we have Parshas Kisisa, which is the golden calf. Then we have the next 2 weeks, actually next just week, because it's a combined parsha, Vayakel and Pekudei. Vayakel and Pekudei is Moshe Rabbeinu coming to the Jewish people to communicate the command to build a Mishkan. It's almost a repetition of Truma and Tetzaveh, where the Jewish people are then commanded to build the Mishkan.
Why is it repeated then?
Okay, so that maybe we'll do next week. There's all kinds of reasons why it's repeated, because there's different ideas. Hashem's command, there's people's command. But it is repeated. So it comes in two parts, right? So there's a machlokes. We know that ein muktam u'mu'chah b'Torah. There's no chronological order to the Torah, sometimes. And therefore, there's a dispute of exactly how the order of events went. So we have three opinions. Okay, one opinion says that it all happened before the golden calf. That the building of the Mishkan, the instruction that Hashem gave to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu's command to the Jewish people and the beginning of construction all happened before the golden calf. I think it's the view of the Zohar, if not mistaken. Some say no. Some say what happened was like this. That the command to build the Mishkan was given before the sin of the golden calf. In other words, some say the order is actually the way it's written in the Chumash. That the command was given to Moshe Rabbeinu before the golden calf. In the middle, the golden calf happened. Yeah, and then eventually when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second luchos, he then gave the command. So it was given before, and then he communicated the command afterwards to the Jewish people. And a third opinion we find in Midrashim is that no, everything happened afterwards. There was the golden calf, and then the whole thing came, the golden calf, the whole purpose of the golden calf, of the Mishkan, was to be an atonement for the Mishkan, for the golden calf, and therefore the command from Hashem and the implementation was all given afterwards. Right? Okay, so that's a historic dispute. What comes out from that dispute, however, is a very interesting philosophical idea. Because these three, the Jewish people divided themselves into from getting the Torah, right? From Nisan, from the Wen Adam Mitzrayim, until Yom Kippur, the Jewish people went through three stages. And the three stages were like this. When they came out of Egypt, Hashem schlepped them out. He elevated them out of the impurity of Egypt. He did it all for them. He transformed them into new creations. And standing at Har Sinai, the Jewish people were like people who were reborn, so to speak, completely new entities, pure, absolutely pure neshamas, right? Like tzaddikim, like a tzaddik that's born a tzaddik, like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, we know, was born pure. The Jewish people at Har Sinai were almost at the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. They were complete tzaddikim. They had been completely lifted out of any problems that had to do with Mitzrayim, and they stood at Har Sinai completely pure people. Right? That's the level of a tzaddik. From the time that they served the golden calf till Yom Kippur, they descended from a tzaddik into being Rishayim. They were wicked people. They had sinned. They had sinned and they had not yet been forgiven. But then, coming closer to Yom Kippur, they did tshuva. And Hashem forgave them. And then Moshe Rabbeinu came down on Yom Kippur with a second luchos, and they were forgiven, and then they were atoned for, and then they became Baalei Tshuva. They became people who did Tshuva. Right? In other words, the definition of a Baal Tshuva is someone that did sin, but yet worked it through and reconnected, and is now atoned for. Right? So a tzaddik symbolizes someone who's got essential purity. The Rosha is someone who's connected to evil. The Baal Tshuva is someone who was connected to evil, but worked through it, and is now atoned for. So according to these three disputes, these three opinions, we have an interesting thing. According to one opinion, the whole command of the Mishkan is given to tzaddikim. It's for tzaddikim. The command and the implementation of the command, the communication of the command, was all given before the golden calf took place. In other words, the whole Mishkan was given to a tzaddik, to Jews, the Jewish people, as they were tzaddikim. According... Yep. That's the point I want to make. Hold on a second. That's a very good question. That's exactly the point I'm going to make. Right? The second opinion, which is the opinion that the whole thing, the other extreme, that the whole thing took place after the golden calf, the command and the implementation of the command, means that the entire thing, the entire process was given to the Baal Tshuva. Right? After they sinned and after the Tshuva, then came the command. But then there's the third opinion, which we said, that the command was given before, but not communicated till after, which is an interesting thing. That means the command was given before, but it was communicated after the golden calf, after Yom Kippur, which means that the command was in effect the whole time that they were Rishayim. So it means they were getting that command even as they were in the state of Rishayim. Right. Which teaches us an important lesson. What's the process of making a Mishkan? The process of making a Mishkan means to be able to create an environment, a physical environment where Hashem's presence is felt. It's the concept of bringing Hashem down into this world. Yeah. So there are three approaches. One approach is that a tzaddik doesn't need a mishkan, like you just said. A tzaddik is someone who's so spiritual, why should he need to build a mishkan? So that's why we have the view that no, the whole mishkan was given to tzaddikim. Because even a tzaddik, who might be an incredibly spiritual person, a tzaddik also has to involve him or herself in bringing Hashem down to this world. He can't just remain spiritual. He's got to connect Hashem to the physical world. Then there's the viewpoint that maybe the Mishkan only belongs to tzaddikim. In other words, the power of making a Mishkan is maybe something only a tzaddik can do. Right? Comes along the Torah and says no. The Baal Tshuva has to make the Mishkan as well. Baal Tshuva also. You work through the challenge, now you have to transform that challenge. You were involved in the world, you were involved in the impurity of the world, you need to now transform it and turn it into a Mishkan. Turn the evil into a Mishkan. But then there's a third opinion that says that you can't wait. Even a person that thinks that they're still in the middle of the problem, they're still in the middle of the challenge and haven't worked through it yet, so they think they need to wait until they're completely atoned for before they can involve themselves in a Mishkan. Hashem says, no, the Mishkan's command even applies to the Rosha. Every person, even a person who hasn't even done a proper tshuva, can still make his environment or her environment into a Mishkan. And that's why we have the three different viewpoints of how the Mishkan was actually communicated, to show that every person can make a Mishkan. Which, by the way, and that's got to do with this parasha, because it's got to do with the whole sequence, right? Which also has to do, just very briefly, with the fact that in the Mishkan there were three metals that we used: Zahav, Kesef, and Achoshes, gold, silver, and copper. And I think we might have asked this question by a different shiur, why copper was used? Because copper is an inferior metal, we are told. In fact, the word copper comes from the word Nachoshes, which is Nachosh, snake, right? So it says in Sfarim like this, that same idea, because Kesef comes from the word Lichsoif, to love, Nichsoif, Nichsafta. Kabbalistically, the Kesef represents the Tzaddik. Zohav is like fire, gold is like fire, it's the passion of a Balshuva. And Nachoshes represents the Nachosh, the person that's still involved in the evil, the Rosh. And that's why the Mishkan was made out of all three metals, Zohav, Kesef, and Nachoshes, to teach us that the Mishkan applies to all three levels, the Balshuva, the Tzaddik, and even the Rosh. Good?
When they built the Mishkan, did they not